millions of Iranians have cast their ballots to elect the members of the country's parliament and the Assembly of Experts. The number of Palestinian lives lost to the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has topped 30,200 as the deadly bombings continue unabated. And the World Health Organization says almost all the lifelines in Gaza have been cut and the health system in the besieged territory is more than on its knees. Thank you for joining us. Polls closed in Iran's key elections for the parliament and the assembly of experts after voting hours were extended three times. The process of vote counting has already started and it is expected that the first results will be released on Saturday. In the elections, 290 parliamentary seats are up for grabs. Those elected will serve for 4 years in the parliament. Voters also cast their ballots for 88 seats in the assembly of experts, where experts are elected for 8 years. More than 61 million people were eligible to vote in both elections. Iranian voters have expressed their unwavering support for the Islamic Revolution by actively participating in the ongoing elections. Iranians say they deeply believe in the power of their collective voice and the democratic processes in the Islamic Republic. Let's take a listen to what they had to say.
With our votes, we want to show that despite problems and deficiencies in the country's governance, the people are wholeheartedly supporting the revolution, their national interests, and their country.
We have to fulfill our duty to the extent we can. Yes, there are many problems, too many problems. We're sad and we voice our criticism as much as we can. God willing, those responsible will think about them and probably many of them do care.
I feel that the participation is much better than last time and in my opinion, people are optimistic about the elections.
With all the propaganda that hostile media made, I think the turnout would be higher than the previous round.
Iran's Constitutional Council has the important role of overseeing the electoral process and confirming the final results of the elections. Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi earlier talked to the spokesperson of the council, Hadi Tahan Nazif, at a polling station in Tehran. Let's take a listen.
We've witnessed the voting of our people from the very early hours. And as you can see, in midday, we see such great crowds here. And this shows that people deem it important to use their right. The future of the country is important to them. The future of themselves and their children are important to them. Thank God that there's been no problem since the beginning of voting and everything has been smooth and facilitated and people are casting their ballots in the two parliamentary elections and the Assembly of Experts elections. Since the morning, we've been overseeing the elections. We have not seen any special irregularity since the morning. Some minor issues have been removed. We have not had any special problem. As well as the 230,000 public supervisors, we have also introduced a system so that all the 80 million population of Iran can supervise the election. So if there is any potential irregularity, they could document it for us.
Religious minorities in Iran are also casting their ballots alongside their fellow countrymen in the nation's legislative and assembly of experts elections. The Archbishop of Tehran says elections are the sign of stability in any country.
Usually, elections taking place in any place, it is a sign of that country's stability. And now in Iran, when the election of the parliament is going on peacefully, rightly, this is a sign of the Iranian society's well-being. Therefore, it is important to participate in the election. Election, as I said, it's a sign of sound society. And thanks God that in Iran, the election that is taking place, it's a sign of the sound of society in Iran.
Now switching to Gaza, and Israel's genocidal campaign continues with scores of Palestinians killed and hundreds more injured in just 24 hours. In the latest attacks, Israeli forces targeted Al Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City in the center of the besieged strip, killing several civilians and leaving many others injured. The regime's forces also launched strikes on the southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis. Israeli attacks have also been claiming the lives of captives held in Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says seven captives were killed as a result of the recent Israeli attacks, including three who were shot dead. The death toll from the Israeli onslaught on Gaza since October the 7th has now surpassed 30,200. More than 71,000 have also been injured. According to Gaza's health ministry, at least 13 children have starved to death in the besieged territory in recent days. The World Health Organization described this as a very sad threshold.
A very sad threshold, similar sad as the 30,000 deaths we reached all over Gaza. And similar like those, these are official records. And as you all point out, exactly, the unofficial numbers can unfortunately be expected to be higher. And once we see them registered in hospitals, once we see them registered officially, it's already further down the line. The system in Gaza is, well, we said it many times, it's on its knees, it's more than on its knees. The fresh water supply has been cut off since immediately after 7 October. The electricity has been cut off since immediately after the horrifying attacks of the 7th of October. All the lifelines in Gaza have more or less been cut. So, and all this leads to a desperate situation, as we saw yesterday in the unfortunate, horrifying incidents where hundreds of people got killed. While there's a while the Secretary General mentioned exactly that an investigation should show what the real causes were, that's not even right now important. Important is that people are so desperate for food, for fresh water, for any supplies, that they risk their lives in getting any food, any supplies to support their children, to support themselves. This is the real drama. This is the real catastrophe here. That food and supplies are so scarce that we see these situations coming up. And the food supplies have been cut off deliberately. Let's not forget that. We saw pictures from Al-Shifa where victims of the attacks, of the horrifying situation yesterday, of the killings, were lying next to each other on the floor awaiting any type of treatment. This is the real drama here. And that is why, despite to the calls now that this may delay the ceasefire, this just underlines more and more that we need an urgent ceasefire now. If not now, when then?
Speaking Since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October, it has spared no one and no place, including homes, hospitals, schools and mosques. In an act of defiance and resistance, Palestinians in the southern city of Rafah have been holding Friday prayers over the ruins of one such mosque called Al-Farouk. Let's take a listen to what some of them had to say.
War that affects many mosques and hospitals. Why destroy and bomb houses of God? What is the fault of the children who are orphaned in the face of this destruction and organized terrorism, covered by official international endorsement from states and from the West? These mosques refuse to be silenced, and the call to prayer will continue to resound, growing louder. Despite this occupier and their arrogance, we must uphold God's rituals and continue to hold Friday prayers in this place.
Our message to the entire Islamic nation is to look at the condition of Muslims and the state of the mosques in the Gaza Strip. The occupation may have destroyed nearly 500 mosques or more. Now, out of 1,250 mosques in the Gaza Strip, almost half have been destroyed by the occupation. Our message to the Islamic and Arab nations is that they must include these mosques in their future plans so that we can rebuild the houses of God and hold prayers, Friday prayers, and congregational prayers in them, and tease the enemies to establish mosques again.
We pray in this place because I opened my eyes to this mosque since I was young. At the age of 6, I used to pray in this mosque. We're residents of this area. The mosque is not even 200 meters from my house, and we have prayed in it all our lives, even when it was bombed. It is not enough for them to destroy the morale of the Palestinian people, demolish homes, kill people, and wipe out entire families. But this is not just the goal of the Israeli aggression on mosques. Rather, the goal is to prevent the spread of religion and Islamic awareness among the people.
The United Nations says many of the victims of the deadly food convoy incident in Gaza City had gunshot wounds despite Israeli claims that the incident was a stampede. The spokesman for the UN Secretary General says the gunshot wounds has been confirmed by the UN team during a visit to Al-Shifa Hospital where many of the victims were taken. Stefan Djurdjaric's comments echo those by the director of Al-Auda Hospital in Jabalia. Mohamed Salha earlier said 142 out of the 176 of the victims of the Thursday incident taken to the hospital had gunshot wounds. Eyewitnesses also say Israeli soldiers opened fire on starving Palestinians who were waiting for the aid. The attack left 112 people dead and hundreds of others wounded. Palestinians injured when the aid trucks entered Gaza on Thursday evening say Israeli forces shot them as they rushed to get food for their families. Here's the account of the incident by some of the wounded Palestinians.
When the aid trucks arrived, I went there, and then the tank and the drone began to fire. I got injured in the back, and I was bleeding for an hour until someone from my relatives came and took me to the hospital.
We were in Al-Rashid Road waiting for aid. At 3:30, they started firing shells and shooting at people. We were on the beach. My son ran to the beach and they shot him twice. One grazed his head and the other in his chest.
We are very hungry. We don't have food or anything. They fired shells at us. They attacked us. They squashed us. They shot at us. There is no food. There is nothing. We want flour to eat. They shot the little ones. They humiliated us. They threw gas at us.
Intense battles are also continuing on the ground in Gaza with Palestinian resistance fighters repelling attacks by Israeli forces. The military wing of the Islamic Jihad has released a new video showing its fighters clashing with Israeli soldiers in and around Al-Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. The Al-Quds Brigades also launched mortar shells at a gathering of regime soldiers in northern Gaza and near Erez Crossing. Also in the north, the Mujahideen brigades hit a Merkava tank with missiles. The resistance groups also said they had shot down an Israeli drone in the southeastern part of the Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv says a total of 242 Israeli soldiers have been killed since the ground fighting began in Gaza in late October. Palestinian resistance groups, however, say Israel is concealing the actual number, which is much higher. And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Foreign interference in European affairs is frowned upon, unless that interference comes from the Zionist regime and its supporters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Foreign interference in European affairs is frowned upon unless that interference comes from the Zionist regime and its supporters." A group called the European Leadership Network has been responsible for much of the interference. The European Leadership Network's goal is to make lawmakers on both sides of the Atlantic equally beholden to the Zionist regime. Its website notes that while 80% of US Congress members have visited Israel, only 10% of European counterparts have done so. To rectify that imbalance, the group regularly organizes junkets to the West Asia region. Since October 7th, it has hosted 12 solidarity missions for politicians who approve of the genocidal war against Gaza. Involving sojourns in luxury hotels, the trips have invariably been expensive. One British lawmaker estimated that the bill for his participation in a recent four-day visit hosted by the European Leadership Network exceeded $2,500. Despite how it is buying influence, the activities of and the agenda pursued by the European Leadership Network have been subject to hardly any scrutiny in the mainstream media. Although its fundraising arm is based in Illinois, many of the group's activities are coordinated from its Tel Aviv office. That office is headed by Emmanuel Navon, a self-proclaimed scholar and practitioner of diplomacy. Navon was born and raised in France before moving to Israel as an adult. It is a testament to Navon's political acumen that he and his staff have cultivated strong relations with the European Union and other pillars of the West, while taking positions that are at complete variance with their stated values. Navon, for example, does not believe in the principle of equality to which the EU is nominally wed. In 2018, Navon, then part of the right-wing Colette Policy Forum, wrote a piece for the Jerusalem Post defending the Zionist regime's nation-state law. Through that law, The child killer regime of Israel implicitly confirmed that it operates an apartheid system in which Jews are given a higher status than people of other religions or ethnicity. In 2020, Navon contended that Europe should rethink its position to the Zionist regime, threats that it may formally annex a large part of the occupied West Bank. Navon used convoluted reasoning to claim that annexation, the possible extension of Israeli sovereignty, as he called it, would be consistent with international law. Undoubtedly erudite, at least in his own head, Navon is not actually a trained lawyer. His attempts over the past few weeks to dismiss how the International Court of Justice has found there is a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide are therefore meritless. Rather than dealing with the substance of the case, he has sought to besmirch South Africa, the government which brought it. South Africa has displayed a moral clarity in holding the child killer regime of Israel accountable. Yet Navon insists, without proof, that South Africa has only initiated proceedings because it is on the payroll of Qatar and Iran. Although the European Union initially backed the genocidal war on Gaza, fallaciously presenting it as an act of self-defense by the Zionist regime, the death toll is too high now for some key players, the Brussels hierarchy. Josep Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, has made that point. Navon's bloodthirst has still not been quenched. He recently described as necessary the threatened major offensive against Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city, where more than 1 million people displaced people are now crammed in appalling conditions. Josep Borrell need not worry about Gaza's civilians. In the event of such an attack, Navon has said, repeating Israeli regime assurances that non-combatants will be safely evacuated. Perhaps the only thing less sincere than an official assurance from the Zionist regime's government or military is Navon's own attempt to pretend he cares about civilian life. He has, in effect, excused the bombardment of hospitals, the destruction of mosques, and desecration of graves by baselessly claiming that they are hiding places for Hamas. Navon has made equally absurd allegations against the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. In a bizarre video, he has sought to dress up the Zionist regime's allegations about Hamas having tunnels beneath UNRWA's Gaza offices as facts. UNRWA administrators surely knew about the digging under their building, according to Navon. It would be comforting if we could simply treat such propaganda as evidence-free idiocy, yet it is part of a concreted push to deny Palestinians the essential services that UNRWA provides. Smear campaigns have been run against the UN agency for quite a few years, as it has been designed to distract from the slaughter and starvation which the Zionist regime is inflicting on Gaza. The latest smear campaign is surely the most sinister so far.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us contemplate on what Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, the fifth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has said about Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. The master of the command was named as the Mahdi because he will dig out the Torah and other heavenly books from the cave in Antioch. He will judge among the people of the Torah according to the Torah, among the people of the Gospel according to the Gospel, among the people of the Psalms according to the Psalms, and among the people of the Quran in accordance with the Quran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, we both have a physical body and a spiritual body. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it's an honor here, dear friends, talking about Islamic lifestyle. So we want to talk a little bit about this idea that we have both a physical body and a spiritual body, if you will. So, of course, we all know about our physical body. We know, you know, that we grow, we know, you know, our hands, our feet, our eyes, our ears, this physical body that we all have. Now, what's really interesting is when it comes to lifestyle in general, people have a tendency to really take care of their physical body. It's interesting, there's so many different products and there's so many different diets and there's so many, I don't know, different guidelines that the modern world has come up with for us to be physically fit, for us to be physically strong and capable of doing what we need to do in our lives. It seems like there's just a new fad or a new diet that's out there all the time trying to promote itself as being, you know, the best way to keep physically fit. So this is one aspect of the body. And when we're talking about a Islamic lifestyle, of course, one of the important aspects of a Islamic lifestyle is to have a healthy physical body. And this physical body is really, you know, what we use to walk around. And it's interesting, in a lot of the traditions, we find that physical fitness and physical health is considered to be one of the greatest benefits and one of the greatest blessings that Allah, the Almighty, has given every single one of us. And truly, when an individual becomes sick or they're ill or ailing, that's when you really begin to understand the importance of the physical body. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how we both have a physical body and a spiritual body. Now, we talked in the first segment a little bit about physical body and how it's really important, and it is considered to be one of the greatest blessings of the Almighty Allah is to have a physically fit, a physically healthy body. But of course, we spend so much time on this physical body of ours, we really should think about the spiritual aspect of each and every single one of us. And just as we have certain diets and we have certain guidelines in order to keep the physical body fit and healthy, we also have spiritual guidelines and spiritual diets, if you will, in order to keep our spiritual life healthy. It's interesting that both of these must be in balance, both the physical body and the spiritual body, quote unquote, even though the spirit is not necessarily contained within a vessel, if you will. But we have spiritual aspect of the human being and we have the physical aspect of the human being. And Islam beautifully addresses both the physical needs as well as the spiritual needs of human beings. Now, this connection with the Almighty Allah, this behaviors and morals and manners and virtues that every single one of us try to achieve in our lives, these are all are part of our spiritual self, these moral ethical virtues which elevate every single one of us and make us into better human beings trying to achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. Before we get to the discussion with the panel, let's review some of the day's developments. A temporary pause on the horizon. U.S. President Joe Biden says apartheid Israel is ready to halt the genocidal war on Gaza for the holy month of Ramadan, as Gaza ceasefire talks continue. British-founded charity Oxfam says Israel is ignoring the International Court of Justice's provision on starvation in Gaza. Meanwhile, more cross-border strikes between Israel and Hezbollah as the Lebanese resistance movement targets an Israeli military base with a barrage of retaliatory rockets. Also, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK on a future Palestinian government that will include all Palestinian factions and the centrality of the anti-war movement in Britain to ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, his words. In less than 5 months, apartheid Israel has killed some 30,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 70,000 others, most of those murdered women and children. Time now to introduce our panel in the studio, theater director and writer Jonathan Chadwick, alongside journalist and author Frank Hughes, who is joining us from the north of Ireland via Skype. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Jonathan. A genocide case and an apartheid case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, filed only a month apart. How isolated are Israel and its staunchest allies, backers like the US, the UK, and Germany?
Increasingly, I would say. I think it represents a real escalation of their isolation in the world. You don't mean isolated from each other, presumably, because that's also a part of the chemistry that will happen as things start to go badly for Israel and the Americans. They will start to try to depart company, and that's inevitable. We've seen that in US behavior in the past, in other places. But I would say, I think it's a part of the isolation process, and I think it's only coming just so late. so late to save lives in Palestine, I don't think it's going to mean that the Israelis are going to change course. In fact, the isolation of these entities may intensify the feelings within them of having to pursue the course that they're pursuing in terms of trying to fight their way out or genocide their way out of the situation. So I don't think, I think it's both, you know, you can cheer the International Court of Justice, and certainly bringing a case about occupation is absolutely right, isn't it? That is the problem, and actually for it to be revealed to be the problem, which you can so easily ignore, that is really, really important to get that actually out in the open.
And the tens of submissions that were given at the ICJ on the legality or illegality of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory, some would say they were so good they had to become lectures at the universities for students. Farah, the same question to you. I guess I want to rephrase it and ask you what you think is the significance of the fact that there have been two such cases, one genocide brought forth by South Africa, and the other one on occupation or apartheid against Israel at the ICJ.
Well, I think it's the first time in the history of the Israeli state that they have actually been brought to the International Court of Justice and are being held accountable for their crimes against humanity, for the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank, the continued expansionist settlement policies. And I think America and the UK and the EU have all been exposed as being fully complicit in not only the birth of Israel in 1948, but with American help in 1967, they started and they won the Six-Day War, which led to the illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So I think on many levels, we are seeing a turning point in history, in international relations, and in the international perception of the global public of what Israel really is, which is a racist, apartheid, expansionist state. Israel is one of the only countries in the world to refuse to defend its borders. So far from finishing its onslaught on Gaza and the West Bank, if it continues to be held unaccountable, it will continue to expand into other nations, to include Syria and Lebanon and Egypt. So it's important going forward that people see what is really happening on the ground through social media. And in real time, we are watching the genocidal carpet bombing and now the starvation of 2.4 million people.
Farah, the ceasefire being mentioned, as I mentioned earlier also, is only temporary. There seems to be no permanent solution thus far, at least as far as now is concerned.
Yes, and in order to end the violence that we're witnessing, all we need is for America and Joe Biden to stop sending money, arms, and giving political cover to the Zionist apartheid regime. The whole idea of this ceasefire really comes down to one thing, and that is the internal pressure that Netanyahu is under from the relatives of the people that are held prisoner in Gaza by the resistance groups. These people are on the streets, tens of thousands of them, demanding an early election, demanding Netanyahu resigns or steps down from government. And what they want is the release of the hostages. So everything we're witnessing and everything we're hearing, including America going from vetoing even the word ceasefire in UN resolutions to accepting it, is purely to allow some form of negotiated settlement to allow the release of the Israelis, many of the members of the IDF that are held in Gaza. They want them out, and then I would imagine that the massacre of Rafah would continue apace as soon as those people are released.
I want to talk about what the Palestinian ambassador had to say, which was the pro-Palestine processions, the marches and rallies that we've seen happen for more than 4 months here in the UK. He called the UK or London the epicenter of international activism for Palestinian liberation. And yet, at the same time, you hear comments from government officials recently MP Lee Anderson saying what people have called Islamophobic against the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, which people say is symptomatic of the deep Islamophobia inside the political party itself. What do you make of that, the divide between how the Palestinian ambassador thinks of these processions and what the government here thinks of these people?
Yeah, I put the epicenter of resistance to the oppression of the Palestinian people close to the Red Sea, personally. I think that it's very, very important, the movement that's happening here, because it is a recognition of an enormous sense of togetherness and solidarity between people here that feel very, very strongly about the Palestinian people and can see within the movement for Palestinian liberation their own struggle. But, the British state is heading in a really disastrous direction, and it's been doing so ever since the 2001. This is just the war on terror repeddled, and they're trying to play that tune again and again and again and again, trying to make out that the Muslim population of this country are in some way contiguous with terrorism, contiguous with migrants. This is politics of disaster, and it's disastrous politics. And they're going to end up where other speakers of this sort who indulge in exclusionary politics end up in the dustbin of history.
On the ash heap of history. Farah Hughes, I'd like to get your reaction to the same question. The way the government here and perhaps the political establishment altogether have approached or treated the pro-Palestine solidarity campaign that's been ongoing, of course, for decades, but went into overdrive since this genocidal war on Gaza started.
Well, I think we've maybe noticed over the last few years, maybe the last decade, how much the Israeli lobby and how much the parties, both Labour Friends of Israel and the Conservative Friends of Israel, and even if we go slightly farther afield, when we go to America, you see all the presidential candidates going to the Wailing Wall in East Jerusalem. So I think what we have is a coalescence of British politics with Zionist foreign policy and Zionist policy within Gaza. We have seen the British establishment moved to the point where they tried to ban Palestinian flags. I was recently at a Palestinian rally here in the north of Ireland, and I was one of the speakers. And the police were there recording everything that was being said by the speakers on the day. Presumably, if someone had said something that could be seen as being anti-Semitic or indeed being seen in favour of the resistance groups, you have the right under international law to resist by all means necessary the illegal occupation of their land and their country. We're witnessing the state and the state establishments moving into an anti-Palestine and a pro-Israeli zone. And a part of that is this encouragement of Islamophobia from Tommy Robinson and people on the right, as far as the Conservative government, where they are pushing the narrative where people who are Muslims in this country could be seen as a fifth column working to destabilize the nation. So part of that is an attempt to, I believe, the Zionists have for many, many decades tried to change anti-Semitism into Islamophobia. They are trying to portray the Muslims as the terrorist threat to the world, and that Israel and the Zionist state is not a threat to anybody, but any Muslim anywhere in the world is a potential threat to the country that they live in.
Absolutely. Zionism, the ideology of division, no doubt. Gentlemen, we're fresh out of time. Jonathan Chadwick and Bra Hughes, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Until we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
German Central Bank has warned economic output is expected to decline again in the first quarter of the year. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote, the struggle in German economy may shrink further in the first quarter of 2024. The country's central bank has warned in a monthly report published recently. According to the forecast, Germany's external industrial demand is likely to remain weak, while consumers will continue to be cautious with spending and domestic investment will suffer further from high interest rates. There is still no recovery for the German economy. Some stress factors will probably remain in the first quarter of 2024. Economic output will therefore again show a slight decline. With the second consecutive decline in economic output, the German economy would be in a technical recession. And that's what Bundesbank said, referring to the final quarter of 2023 when the country's GDP contracted by 0.3% in annual terms. Analysts link Germany's weak economic performance with the after-effects of the energy crisis that gripped the country after the start of the Ukraine-Russia tension. Western states placed numerous economic restrictions on Russia, which led to the bloc largely losing access to Russian energy. This dealt a particularly strong blow to Germany's industry-heavy economy, which is now in its fourth straight quarter of zero or negative growth. Germany was the only G7 economy to contract last year. Economists, including the country's two largest lenders, Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank, recently predicted another contraction in 2024. According to a DIHK Chambers of Industry and Commerce poll, local businesses expect the EU's largest economy to shrink by 0.5% this year. German businesses expect the country's economy to contract by 0.5% this year, which would mark the second straight year of decline and the worst downturn in 20 years. A poll of over 27,000 companies carried out by the DIHK Chambers of Industry and Commerce revealed, of those surveyed, 35% expect business to deteriorate over the next 12 months, while only 14% expect an improvement. Meanwhile, 29% of respondents rated the current state of the business climate as good, while 22% expressed the opposite view. The 0.5% decline projected by DIHK poll contrasts with the German government's official projection of 0.2% growth. Germany has been hit by a severe crisis in recent years as energy prices have surged, while a shortage of skilled workers and weak domestic demand weigh on the nation's economic performance. GDP declined by 0.3% year-on-year in 2023, making it the only G7 economy to shrink in 2023. The DIHK said the bad mood among companies is becoming more entrenched, adding that if the poll's projection comes to pass, it would be only the second time in Germany's post-war history that the economy contracted for 2 years in a row. The country did face similar challenges back in 2002 and 2003, when two consecutive recessions forced Berlin to introduce aggressive labor market and welfare reforms that were credited with elevating the competitiveness of the country's economy. DIHK head Martin Wensblen said in a statement, "This is a clear alarm signal that Germany and Europe must take seriously." The European Commission had previously issued a downbeat projection that Germany would be the biggest drag on EU growth in both 2023 and 2024, with modest gains of 0.3% in 2024 and 1.2% in 2025. Midstream.
Last week, the second edition of the Paris meeting took place in the French capital, attended by representatives from Zionist Israel, the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, with the aim of solidifying the negotiating framework that will guide the indirect negotiations between the Palestinian resistance Hamas and the Israeli entity. However, after the Israeli entity signed backtracked from what was agreed upon in Paris previously under the direction and pressure of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who prevented his negotiating team from returning to Cairo to continue the talks and had stripped them of their powers, delegating his special advisor instead. This made it clear that no one can trust the commitment of the occupation even to what it and the mediators would agree upon in Paris too. Moreover, it is evident that the U.S. administration exerted strong pressure on the Israeli regime, specifically on Netanyahu, to push for the meeting and attempt to reach a deal in the coming weeks. Americans and other mediators are striving to finalize an exchange agreement and a temporary ceasefire before the onset of the holy month of Ramadan in about 2 weeks. They believe that the continued fighting during the fasting month, along with the anticipated restrictions imposed on Palestinians in the West Bank and the occupied territories regarding access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, would constitute the perfect recipe for significant and comprehensive escalation within occupied Palestine as a whole and even in the region, given that the holy month of Ramadan has typically witnessed clear security escalations in recent years. It has now become clear that the Israeli occupation seeks to close the file of captives in order to resume its field operations, relieved from the pressure of this issue, which burdens the Israeli entity decision-maker and does not grant him wide maneuvering margins, whether in combat or at the negotiating table. However, on the other hand, Hamas realizes that this issue is one of the most influential factors on the Israeli entity leadership and its performance in the war, which means that Hamas will not rush to abandon it unless what it gets in return is no less than an agreement on a ceasefire. However, Netanyahu remains adamant against any formula that includes a long-term truce or a temporary cessation of hostilities for long months, as it seems that he has not yet made a real decision whether or not to invade Rafah.
In related context, Egyptian sources informed the Wall Street Journal that Hamas is ready to agree to the Israeli occupation's release of 3,000 Palestinian detainees during the exchange deal. But the Zionist soldiers' captives will remain with the Palestinian resistance until a permanent agreement is reached for a comprehensive ceasefire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. It seems that the decision regarding the Rafah operation is still pending, not only due to field-related reasons, as the attack on Rafah requires different and more complicated preparations than what happened in other areas, but also because the situation there is contingent upon the positions of other parties in the war, whether they are partners to Zionist Israel or maybe mediators who at this stage refuse any attack on the city of Rafah and prefer a negotiated path to end the fighting, albeit under different names, through a relatively improved prisoner swap deal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, political analyst and lawyer expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Omar. Now, as talks are underway in Paris, and possibly as Reuters said the other day that they might continue in Qatar, does the Israeli regime really seek to maybe end his captives' file where the pressure would be released from there and then continue his military campaign inside of Gaza with more intensity? Or is it really a very tense situation internally for Netanyahu that the Zionist entity has to be pushed into stopping this aggression, this genocidal aggression against Gaza?
Yes, well, now for more than 140 days, the genocide in Gaza is ongoing. The Israeli army has been killing people constantly since more than 140 days, using more than 60,000 tons of explosives and bombs thrown at an area that is not much larger than 360 square kilometers, where 2 million people are squeezed in this area, and now they're squeezed even more in a 50 square kilometer zone near Rafah, near the Egyptian border, where the Netanyahu and the Israelis are threatening, and they are bombing. They are bombing Rafah. Last night they bombed Rafah. They killed, every day they're killing around 100, 150 civilians in the Rafah area. They want to do a full invasion there. And, well, they're using this in the negotiations, and that's so unethical. You know, you don't go to negotiations and threaten people, threaten civilians with massacres in order to improve the conditions in the negotiations. This is a total outrage. I mean, this is what Netanyahu's government has been doing. They've been putting on the table, you know, they want to win time, so they want to delay these negotiations as much as possible while they spill the blood of innocent civilians in Rafah and continue to destroy every possible means of life in Gaza and in Rafah more specifically now. Mm-hmm. This is outrageous. I mean, the negotiations were supposed to be over four different areas. First, the exchange of the prisoners. Mm-hmm. Second, the ceasefire, cessation of hostilities and bombing of civilian infrastructure, civilian hospitals, everything that has to do with life in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And fourth, the removal, the withdrawal of the Israeli army from the northern part and from parts of Gaza so people can return home. You know, and there is no way that the Palestinians will accept that the Israelis create buffer zones. In fact, the Americans said that they will not accept the buffer zone issue. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is the return of the people to their homes and the start of the reconstruction. Where is all that in the negotiations? They only want the hostages, the prisoner exchange. For the prisoner exchange, okay, the Palestinians were ready to actually offer, saying, okay, fine, we will accept. We will accept to discuss the actual swap of one Israeli to ten Palestinians. Detainees. However, there is no agreement over the names. Because the Palestinians have in mind a list of names of people that Netanyahu is not ready to actually release and exchange. And that is also a serious obstacle.
This is what I want to discuss with you.
But the biggest obstacle, I have to tell you, Marwa, the biggest obstacle is the issue of ceasefire and permanent ceasefire. Because every time there was a deal, and in the previous time when there was the exchange of prisoners, the Israelis intensified the bombardment and intensified the arrests of innocent Palestinians. So what is this exchange about? If every time we do the exchange, the Israeli army goes into the West Bank and in Gaza and arrests thousands
of people, definitely. But because I want to discuss with you the requests by the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, who said that they are ready to exchange the captives, the Israeli captives they have, with 3,000 Palestinian detainees from Israeli entity prisons. But and they want to keep the soldier captives with them in order to ensure that the ceasefire will happen. Now, whether or not this happens, that's not what we want to discuss. In the event it actually happens, let's say it does actually happen, what kind of proof does the Palestinian side have that the Zionist entity won't just start a new unforeseeable attack against residents' areas in Gaza?
Now, the massacre and the genocide, the Israeli genocide in Gaza has been going on now for more than 5 months. So